The Chicago White Sox are looking for their fifth straight victory in the middle game of a three-game series with last place Cleveland. That game is under the lights tonight. Last night's 10-6 win put the Sox within two games of AL Central leading Detroit. The Boston Celtics have signed veteran forward Rasheed Wallace, one of this year's most coveted free agents. Boston announced the move today, the first day teams were allowed to sign free agents. The 35-year-old Wallace, a four-time All-Star, can play the low post and has exceptional shooting range. He averaged 12 points per game for the Pistons last year. Two-time All-State 400 winner Tony Stewart says he's confident Goodyear has solved the tire problems that plagued last year's race at the Brickyard. The July 26th race at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway will be the first for Stewart as both driver and team owner. Stewart was among the drivers who participated in Goodyear's seven test sessions at the track since last year when the problems turned the race into a series of 10 to 12 lap sprints. That's sports.
Fishing, canoeing, biking, hiking, and free music concerts on Tuesday and Friday nights. You can find it all at Kickapoo State Park. Join us for Music at the Landing with bluegrass band Strings Attached Friday evening from 5:30 to 7:30. This concert is a partnership between WILL and Kickapoo Landing. More information is at 217-446-8399. See you at the park.
Boeing says it's buying the manufacturing operation of a key supplier for its long-delayed 787 Dreamliner. Boeing is based in Seattle, and the manufacturer is in South Carolina. The airplane maker says the move is aimed at improving efficiency, though that's not why people are talking about this deal. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
For years, Boeing has been threatening to move airplane production out of Seattle and to someplace less expensive to do business, a place it wouldn't have to contend with thorny and strike-prone unions. On Tuesday, Boeing announced it would buy the Charleston operations of Voight Aircraft Industries, and that has Washington state leaders, union officials, and others wondering, is this the first step to setting up a second production line for its 787 airplane? Boeing spokesman Jim Prue.
We have made no plans about a second 787 line, and it would be inappropriate for us to comment on that for now.
But a no comment doesn't silence the speculation. While the South Carolina factory has had serious quality and financial problems, it is very well located, surrounded by lots of empty land, with plenty of room to build a second 787 assembly line and potentially build other Boeing jets as well. Scott Hamilton, a Seattle-based analyst who follows Boeing, says the deal might galvanize those who want Boeing to stay here.
Maybe this is the 2x4 upside the head that they need to wake up.
Boeing is now in a stronger position to pit one location against another, and as Hamilton notes, that is not good news for Boeing's Washington state boosters. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Boeing's move comes as Seattle faces a tough real estate market. Nationwide, commercial real estate prices fell close to 9% in the early part of the year. That's according to Moody's Investor Service. The Pacific Northwest, which was somewhat insulated from that kind of trouble, is not insulated anymore. Deborah Wong of member station KUOW reports from Seattle.
There's a buzz of activity at this brand new office building at the edge of downtown Seattle. Workers are rushing to put in flooring, install lighting, and polish up the elevator doors. At any other time, this 28-story office tower would probably be a big draw. It's got great views, a health club, daycare center, there's even concierge service. But on the eve of its grand opening, it's nearly empty. Not a single office tenant has signed a lease.
What we've experienced is fear, paranoia, procrastination.
That's Douglas Howe, the president of Touchstone Corporation, which owns the building. He says it was first conceived back in 2006 at the height of the boom. It was built on spec without any signed deals. But then Seattle was hit not just by the recession, but also by the collapse of Washington Mutual, which was headquartered here. That emptied out hundreds of thousands of square feet of downtown office space.
Those two factors have created what I call kind of a perfect storm for office space. We're oversupplied for all the wrong reasons.
And it's not just Touchstone's problem. Altogether, some 2 million square feet of brand new Class A office space is set to open up in downtown Seattle this year, and about the same amount next year as well. Matthew Gardner is a principal with Gardner Economics, a land use consulting firm.
We're going to be delivering an awful lot of space to the marketplace. And as such, when we have an economy which is currently contracting, and I certainly expect vacancy rates to be well north of 20% by the end of the year.
And as vacancy rates go up, landlords are having to make incredible deals.
How hard do you have to work to keep people?
In this environment, very hard.
That's John Lamb. He's the chief financial officer for Unico, one of the biggest commercial landlords in downtown Seattle. Lamb says in some circumstances, Unico will reduce rents by up to 30% and even give tenants several months rent free.
We're about 90 to 91% occupied, which, you know, is a healthy number, but it doesn't mean that some of our tenants coming up for renewal may not be enticed by another landlord to go somewhere else. So we're working very hard to keep absolutely everyone that we have.
And that means offering all sorts of unusual perks to tenants.
You can just let your thoughts cease. Bring your attention, your awareness to your breath.
Tenants here have been treated to free yoga classes taught in an empty retail space that once held a high-end furniture store. Unico has also set up farmers markets, a bicycle repair shop, and an office tower lobby. It shows free outdoor movies in the summer and gives away reusable grocery bags. Lamb says those are the kind of funky things that tenants seem to like.
And when their lease renewal comes up, all those memories come back and they say, I really like this environment.
You want them to have a warm and fuzzy feeling about you.
Exactly. Not easy to do in today's business climate, but that's what we're trying to do.
Lamb believes vacancy rates here will continue to rise and expects some office buildings to end up in foreclosure. That's already happened in places like Las Vegas and Orange County, California. Across the U.S., the delinquency rate on commercial property loans is at its highest level in 15 years, according to a New York-based research firm, and isn't expected to peak until the year 2011. For NPR News, I'm Deborah Wong in Seattle.
The Bulls are running in Pamplona every morning for 8 days in a row. Daredevils from Spain and around the world sprint in front of a pack of bulls. The annual tradition persists despite a growing distaste for bullfighting in Spain. Jerome Sokolowski was there for the start of the bull runs.
The streets of Pamplona are strewn with broken bottles and slick from spilled sangria. The sun has yet to rise, and this northern Spanish city reverberates with the sound of many tongues, including American-accented English.
I stopped drinking about 4 o'clock, so I had to get about a two-hour power nap.
Brian Malizan is a high school teacher from New York.
And this way I'm ready to go. I feel good. I'm sober. I got all my wits, and that's the way I wanted to have it before I do this run.
Around 2,000 runners are crammed into the narrow alleyways that pass for streets in the medieval heart of Pamplona. The runners are dressed in white and wear red bandanas to symbolize the martyrdom of the city's patron saint, Fermin. Malizan says he often talks about the meaning of the festival with his students back home.
It's part of the culture, it's part of the religion, and it's not about the killing of the bull. It's about the whole experience, it's religious. So, you know, it is what it is. We're here to expand our horizons and ourselves as men.
Nearly everyone is male, and many of them do see it as a kind of macho rite of passage. No one knows when the running of the bulls began, but it's been internationally famous since Ernest Hemingway wrote about it in his book, The Sun Also Rises. Animal rights groups say the run torments the bulls, who meet their death later in the day in the bull ring. In the last decade, they've held protests and appear to be winning some sympathy in Spain. Polls show most Spaniards have no interest in bullfighting. And in Catalonia, nearly 200,000 people have signed a petition asking the regional parliament to ban the ritual. Here in Pamplona, some of the Americans admit they're a bit queasy about bullfighting. Jay Quintano is also a New Yorker whose grandparents were from Spain.
I'd rather see this, the running of the bulls, but afterwards I'd rather not kill them.
A bottle rocket marks the opening of the pen and the beginning of the encierro, the 925-yard dash to the bull ring. The encierro can get bloody if a bull strays from the group. 14 people have been killed here in the last century, and many runners are gored. This run was relatively clean. Afterward, Lewis Goldstein and his friends Jim Heaney and Howard Chank feel the heady release of having survived without a scratch.
A lot of buildup for a 10 to 12 second event. So kind of get real geared up, get the adrenaline flowing, and then boom, you start moving, and all of a sudden the Bulls are just on you and by you.
Would you guys do it again?
Absolutely. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, is that so? You'll be here? Or?
No way. Two of the three of us will.
Cynics would say that the 8 days of round-the-clock insanity and the free-flowing sangria are mostly for the tourists. But plenty of Spaniards say the festival is a vital part of their traditions. Pamplona resident Ramon Moreno has been running with the Bulls since he was 13 years old. Yes, it's crazy, he says, but if you've been fed this with your mother's milk, then this is what you do. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Pamplona, Spain.
Fish is a big part of our diet. We eat everything from fish sticks and fast food fish sandwiches to sushi and swordfish steaks. But as Lester Graham reports, a new documentary makes the case we're overfishing the oceans.
This new film is called The End of the Line.
Everybody recognizes that there's major problems in the world's fisheries. And at one level, it's a question of how bad is it?
That's Bray Hilborn of the University of Washington, one of the scientists in the documentary. The film is a compelling argument that huge fishing trawlers are pushing the fish stocks to the edge. The first sign of a problem was the cod fishery off the coast of Newfoundland. It collapsed in the 1970s. But it seemed, despite problems here and there around the world, the total catch globally was going up every year. That is, until researchers realized just a few years ago, communist officials in China were reporting inflated fish numbers to impress their superiors. The world catch was actually shrinking. Scientists were stunned and worried.
For the first time in human history, the future of the food the world gets from the sea was in doubt.
Sent a shiver down my spine because that was the one thing that a lot of people were holding on to. Well, things may be bad, but at least we're catching lots and we're catching more every year, so it can be that bad.
Boris Worm at Dalhousie University is one of the researchers who confirmed the world catch is getting smaller. He and others have been studying the fact that boats are catching fewer fish, even though the nets are larger and the long lines they put out have more hooks. Claire Lewis produced the End of the Line documentary. She admits this leaves people who see fish as a good source of low-fat protein in a spot.
It's very hard. As a parent, you want to give your children and you want to feed yourself healthy food. You know that that's what fish is. On the other hand, we cannot possibly ignore what we're doing to the oceans in eating too many fish.
Today, in every ocean of the world, high-tech industrial vessels are hunting down every known edible species of fish.
The basic problem in most fisheries that are in trouble is too many boats.
Too much capacity chasing too few fish.
That last speaker is Charles Clover. The film documentary is based on a book he wrote by the same title. Like the film's producers, he wants people to be more aware of the plight of the world's fisheries. Producer Claire Lewis says there are examples where fishing is being controlled more carefully.
The most graphic example, I think, in our film is the fact that in Alaska, which is a very well-managed fishery, they take 10% of the stock only. In the North Sea, in the EU, they take 50% of the stock. Now, it seems to me that that's a really, really big difference.
Lewis believes if left to the big commercial fishing operations, they'd just keep fishing until fish stocks all collapsed. And she believes stricter government regulations and better informed consumers are the only things that will stop them.
I really do believe that it's the individual consumers who are going to make a difference to this. I think it's something we can all individually do.
The film tries to get people to start thinking about what they can do, such as asking about fish before you buy it, letting politicians know a sustainable fishery is important to you, and the film encourages people to get involved with groups such as SeafoodWatch.org. The End of the Line is narrated by actor and environmental activist Ted Danson. It's appearing in theaters across the nation. For the Environment Report, this is Lester Graham.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can hear the report and subscribe to the daily podcast at environmentreport.org.
Singer-songwriter Maya Sharp has been asking herself this question a lot.
How long can she be the girl on her way?
I've been hovering under the radar for a long time now. My first record came out in 1997, and I've seen a lot of close calls, a lot of them.
Maya Sharp on songwriting and success, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Coming up on The World at 3 o'clock, Apollo astronaut Alan Bean returned to Earth covered with moon dust. Now he makes moon art with dusty patches of cloth from his spacesuit. That story and the day's news coming up on The World at 3 o'clock.
Earth and Sky.
Half the people on Earth today are at risk of contracting the disease malaria carried by mosquitoes. And close to 1 million people, mainly children in Africa, die of the disease each year, according to the World Health Organization. But there is hope.
There are some exciting new breakthroughs, and the first is that we now have some new drugs that are very effective against the most severe form of malaria.
You're listening to malaria expert Joel Bremen, a senior scientific advisor at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He said that it might be possible with a combination of new drugs and other measures to eliminate malaria worldwide by 2050.
The new class of drugs based on artemisinin compound is now combined with a whole raft of other drugs, and this type of therapy is very, very effective.
Bremen added that bed nets treated with insecticide offer personal protection against the mosquito that carries malaria.
And an exciting new development is that we now have textile chemistry allowing the insecticide to be woven into the threads, and they last up to 5 years.
More with Joel Bremen on malaria at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
It's 2:57. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our technical director is Jason Croft. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. We're getting ready to make way for The World from PRI. That's coming up next. Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered showers and thunderstorms, highs ranging from around 70 near Lake Michigan to 90 in the far south. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with scattered showers and isolated thunderstorms, mainly in eastern Illinois and western Indiana.